Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. John F. Kerry has struggled to gain ground in the polls despite new questions about President Bush's leadership in Iraq. Voters don't seem to know that much about the Democratic candidate's views, even when they join him in his rallying cry of bring it on. In their new book, John F. Kerry, the complete biography by the Boston Globe reporters who know him best, our guests tonight pry into the background of the candidate, as his hometown paper has been doing for the last three decades. They look at the war hero, the anti-war crusader, the Boston Brahmin, and the man of a thousand opinions. Tonight on Point, taking the magnifying glass to candidate Kerry. What do you want to know about him? What does he stand for? What would he stand for as president? Is John Kerry where he needs to be to win in November? What are his strengths, his weaknesses? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Brian Mooney, reporter and political columnist for the Boston Globe. He's been covering John Kerry for 26 years, and he's also a member of the Boston Globe's Spotlight team, the newspaper's investigative unit. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me. I used to be on the Spotlight team.
Okay, stand corrected. Former member of the Boston Globe Spotlight team. And joining me from Washington is Nina Easton, deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. She is the author of Gang of Five, Leaders at the Center of the Conservative Ascendancy. Hello, Nina.
Hey, nice to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you with us, and should mention that Brian and Nina are two of the three authors of the new book, John Kerry, The Complete Biography. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Jack.
Good to have you on the show, and hello, Nina.
Hey, Jack.
Hi.
Brian, I want to start with you. The title of the book describes it as the complete biography by the Boston Globe reporters who know him best. And then you go to the introduction. There's 9.5 pages of why, contrary to what Kerry might think, the Boston Globe is actually not out to get him. Why was it even necessary to say that, and for 9.5 pages?
Well, I think throughout the campaign, particularly last year when Kerry was trailing in the polls and running a poor campaign, there were a lot of complaints, particularly from his campaign, but also from his supporters, that the Globe was being unusually harsh in its treatment of him. I think most of that had to do with the way the columnists were banging him around quite a bit, because he was running a fairly dreadful campaign, frankly. But and I think Marty Baron, the editor of the paper, who conceived of this project, the seven-part series that this book is based on, which we published last year, felt a need to sort of set the record straight.
Nina, you got to edit the entire manuscript, which was a considerable job in and of itself. What's the sense you got of Kerry as candidate and man? I mean, if you had to describe him in five words, what would they be?
I don't have five words, Gail. I mean, there are really two sides to John Kerry. And when you look at him, I think you have to take both into consideration. There's the independent-minded maverick. You know, this is the guy who beached his boat in Vietnam, defying Navy policy to chase down the enemy. This is the guy who, as a young man, flew his test plane towards the Golden Gate Bridge with the intention, we're not sure which, of doing a loop-de-loop or simply going under the bridge, but was, in any case, stopped by a flock of birds. Then there's this other side of John Kerry that we see on the campaign trail quite often, which is very painstakingly cautious. His critics would say politically calculating. This is the John Kerry who, as a young man, criticized Vietnam and criticized American intervention in Vietnam in his Yale oration at his graduation ceremony, but nevertheless went over there as an officer because it was 1966, and if you wanted to follow in the footsteps of your hero, John F. Kennedy, as he did, that's what you did. So, I think we're seeing both sides of John Kerry. And one of the things that I have to say was we had tremendously rich material to work with, because whatever anybody thinks of John Kerry, His background is riveting. He's got a very complex, just like his personality, his background is extremely complex, rich, interesting, and really one of the most fascinating political figures out there.
Brian, what would you describe as the major rap against Kerry? Too ambitious, too complex, not anchored enough to a sort of core set of beliefs?
Well, those are the principal knocks on Kerry. It's interesting. People, and I've covered Kerry for years, and I've heard all the complaints and the praise for him. And, you know, people want to sort of pigeonhole him or summarize him in succinctly and so often in caricature, and he just doesn't lend himself to that. I mean, there's a real complexity to the man, to his character, to his life, to his the way he thinks, the way he makes decisions. And that can be a real handicap in a campaign. And I think to the extent people are complaining, Democrats particularly, about the Kerry campaign now, it's a function of that. And the Bush campaign is much more adept at sort of drawing the cartoon-like pictures of Kerry for early consumption by the voters.
Which reminds me, Jack Beatty, of another politician, Ronald Reagan, who was described somewhat pejoratively as a simple man. He had a worldview that didn't vary that much from a few basic principles. And now here's Kerry, who's accused of being too complex and too nuanced and too contradictory, which makes you wonder on some level, what is it we expect from our politicians? Is there a middle ground here between too simple and too complex?
Well, I think there is, and I think some of our greatest presidents have occupied it. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was a very complicated man indeed, and he was famous for preserving his options. He said at one point in the Civil War, "My policy is to have no policy. Events set my policy." And he timed major ventures like the Emancipation Proclamation to the political calendar, not just to the military one. But he was extremely complicated religiously, spiritually. Franklin Roosevelt was so complicated in his own way, and he had such a variegated, palette of issues that Herbert Hoover rightly called him a chameleon on plaid. And of course, JFK was not a simple fellow either. Famous for being cautious and for preserving his options and for shading and for, ducking tough votes in the Senate. And, the point is, it isn't all presidents who are of the Reagan and George W. Bush persuasion. There have been a lot of complicated thinkers in that office who've done pretty well.
So it can be done. It's just not so easy.
It's harder to sell politically today because of this, soundbite business. But Bill Clinton had as complicated a mental equipment as anybody who ever ran for president. And, boy, he didn't seem to have any trouble.
Well, and Bill Clinton, of course, like John Kerry, very much influenced by JFK. And Nina, I'm wondering if Kerry's initials were something other than JFK, do you think he would have gotten the political bug quite so early and quite so strongly as he did?
Well, there's no doubt that John F. Kerry was very much influenced by John F. Kennedy. And unlike Bill Clinton, who shook John F. Kennedy's hand on a Boys Nation outing, from a distance, John Kerry's world actually intersected with John Kennedy's to the point where he dated Jackie Kennedy's half-sister. And in fact, we've gotten this book, this terrific photograph of John Kerry sailing on the Narragansett Bay with Kennedy and with Jackie Kennedy's half-sister. So, I think that definitely shaped his ambitions. I do have to say, though, going back to the comparison that Jack made between Kerry and Clinton, Clinton did bring a very, very clear vision of where he was going and his desire to transform the Democratic Party. That was very much part of his early campaign in a way that we haven't seen from John Kerry yet.
And also, Brian, I want to ask you about those younger years. There is this perception that Kerry was born into great wealth and great privilege, but, that really isn't the whole story.
No, his mother was a Forbes and descended from John Winthrop, the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And the Forbes family, many of them made a great deal of money. her end of the family was not that wealthy. I think we described Kerry as like something out of a Jane Austen novel, you know, landless aristocracy. He grew up in that world, the exclusive prep schools, boarding school in Switzerland, rubbed elbows with, you know, as Nina just mentioned, JFK. But he never had the wealth of the people he was surrounded by.
And also,
he
Nina
went to prep school. I was just going to interject here. He went to prep school and very much financed by a great aunt. His father was a foreign service officer and certainly couldn't have afforded the annual tuition of some of those schools he went to.
And in fact, in the book, there's a very poignant quote about how he, after being shipped off to boarding school at a young age, and that he was always saying goodbye, you know, that he didn't seem to have a real sense of place. He went from place to place to place. He didn't have the real rootedness that many Boston politicians have. And what impact did that have?
It's been a problem for him. I mean, his first major run for office for Congress in 1972 in the 5th Congressional District up in the Merrimack Valley, it was the third district he had held an address in a matter of weeks as he sort of shopped around for the best possible district, and he settled on the open seat. And he was basically called a carpetbagger. He won the primary and then lost the general election. And he was really never of the political culture in Massachusetts. He came in at a high level, and I think a lot of people resented that, and he still acknowledges that's part of his baggage in this state, and it still dogs him to this day.
And Nina, do you see that reflected in how he is, his persona?
Well, definitely, Gail. I think this whole notion that label everybody loves to attach to him, aloof and distant, I think his background very much plays into that and helped shape him. And the thing that people should keep in mind about John Kerry, as Brian mentioned, he's not really from a Massachusetts neighborhood. I mean, he spent 5 or 6 years of his youth in Massachusetts. He was born in Denver, though, after the family lived in Massachusetts until he was about 7, I believe. He moved to Chevy Chase, Washington. And then by age 11, he was overseas and was off to boarding schools in Switzerland and then 1 year in Massachusetts, but the other 4 in New Hampshire. So by the time he came back and ran that race that Brian was just talking about, that was many, many years had transpired since he had lived in Massachusetts.
And Jack Beatty, given all of that rich background, do you find it surprising or perhaps predictable that he later emerged as a leader of the anti-war movement? Because as we saw in the book, there were hints of his opposition to the war even before he went. He made this fiery class oration speech at Yale, which he had a pretty insipid one to begin with, which was published, and then he threw it out and came out with this pretty impassioned several pages about why the U.S. needed to rethink its position in Vietnam.
Well, you know, that's part of his complexity, isn't it? I mean, he went because, I take him at his word, if he didn't go, someone else would go. Possibly, too, he went because his hero had gone to war. But it's a pretty risky thing to do in any case. And he behaved and acted nobly over there. There's just no question about that. And then he really was a kind of hero to the anti-war movement. I remember him way back, and I remember seeing him on the Dick Cavett Show, I mean, way back, maybe 1970, 71, debating another Navy guy who's still attacking him, by the way. It was one of these people who attacked him recently. And he was just a kind of hero to people because he had such moral authority. He had been there. He was the man. He suffered. And people listened to him, and he was so eloquent and thoughtful. Anyway, he was sort of a kind of axial figure of his generation on both sides of Vietnam, but in both cases, a kind of leader.
And how do you see that, Brian?
For any of your listeners who are too young to remember, I mean, the Vietnam War, I mean, you can't compare it to what's happening now in Iraq and the opposition to the war. I mean, the country was split down the middle. There were generational differences. There was cultural upheaval. There were, you know, radical political forces, you know, urging the overthrow of the government. I mean, the country was just in an uproar. And for those, particularly veterans, and even people in Kerry's crew, when they heard some of the things he said, were just, you know, astonished and angry. And it lingers to this day. I mean, he still remains within the veterans community, a very polarizing figure.
We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment after we take a little break. We're talking this hour about John F. Kerry's background and candidacy for president. Do you think he deserves to be the next president? Are you voting for him? If so, why? And if not, why not? What makes him a compelling candidate? And what are his weaknesses? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about candidate John Kerry with two Boston Globe reporters who have tracked his career from the beginning. What about Kerry's background makes you like or dislike him as a candidate? Does he have the right experience to be president? What do you want to know about him? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Brian Mooney, I want to pick up with you. You were mentioning a moment ago about how he came back from Vietnam, started to launch a political career, and then lost his first campaign for Congress. What did he do then?
Well, then he decided to go to law school. Excuse me. And I went to Boston College Law School, became a father, and then shocked some of the people he'd come up through the ranks in the anti-war movement with by becoming a prosecutor in the Middlesex County District Attorney's Office. Not only was he a prosecutor, but John Droney, who was then the ailing and aging DA, made him the first assistant. He effectively ran the office, jumping ahead of all these other people who had made a career of being prosecutors in there. And once again, as when he ran for office and jumped to the forefront of the Vietnam War veterans, engendered some resentment. But he was actually very successful in that endeavor, transformed the office, modernized it, and successfully prosecuted some big cases. And I think developed some skills, and Nina, you may want to talk about this, that sort of helped shape him his early years in the Senate. No.
His prosecutor, no. I'm sorry, he wanted to turn to me, I'm sorry, but his prosecutor skills very much were apparent in the Senate. Something to keep in mind about John Kerry is he made his mark very much as an investigator in the 1980s when in his first and second terms of office as a senator. He became known for his work in the Iran-Contra affair, investigating that scandal, in the BCCI scandal. He wasn't like his colleague Ted Kennedy. There aren't laws with John Kerry's name attached. He wasn't a legislator. He was an investigator, and I think this also goes back to how he makes decisions and why it frustrates people, because aides described to us this kind of decision-making style that's extremely Socratic, where he, you know, chews over every side of an issue, where he really loves the back and forth with his staff. He loves to play devil's advocate. And so, you know, his supporters will say sometimes when you see him seeming like he's not taking a stance on an issue, that's his internal thought process that he's displaying publicly. He's just going round and round different facets of an issue. He would frustrate his staff at times where he'd walk onto the Senate floor and they didn't even know how he would vote, or they thought they had decided a position on a particular policy or a bill, and then he would switch at the last minute after hearing a new piece of input. So he seeks input from a lot of different sources. He doesn't have that sort of clean, instinctual style of decision-making that you see on the part of Bush. I'm thinking of the Laura Bush quote I just saw about George Bush, in which, you know, she said he's very instinctual. He makes a decision and then he doesn't go back and revisit it. I do think you see John Kerry going back and revisiting decisions.
I mean, he would cast some of these votes and then come off the floor and give an interview and say, I voted for that bill, but despite all these shortcomings in the bill, it'd be like he was talking himself out of the decision he had just made. I mean, it's interesting to watch.
Well, is that a bad thing to be? Sorry, Jack. Yeah, go ahead.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt. Well, you can see that same tendency to sort of file things down in the difference between his prepared speeches and what he says. Here's a sentence from the prepared speech. Who among us could move on short notice when you don't even know where your paycheck will come from? And this is how he spoke it. Who among us thinks it's right to say so quickly, on short notice, before you can even know where your next paycheck's going to come from, before you know, if you haven't been working, what skill you can apply to be able to earn a paycheck, before you've been able to adjust to the loss and begin to be able to get back into life?
That's a little complicated way of saying, what do you do when you lose your job?
That was Carrie-esque.
But that's so Carrie-esque.
But, Brian, is that a bad thing to be nuanced, to be complicated, to have a thought process that perhaps isn't quite as linear?
I think most Americans would hope that their president was, you know, thoughtful and considered all options. They may be a little off-put by the fact that he verbalizes all his reservations in the course of the discussion. But, John Kerry is a very complicated man, and he sees the world in shades of gray. Everything is... I mean, it's not black and white, good, bad, good or evil. I mean, it is all shades of gray.
All right, let's hear from some of our listeners now to Northampton, Massachusetts first. Luke is on the line. Welcome to the program, Luke.
Hi, thanks.
Go ahead.
I will be thrilled to vote for Kerry. He wasn't, it took a little warming up. But, at this point, I will vote for anybody who knows how to use a fork. Who is running against George Bush. But my question is, what do we have to do to get this guy elected? I mean, I'm almost worried that he's too smart for the job, and I'm beginning to despair that whether there's anything more powerful than money in our political process. And if it surely comes down to a matter of who's got the most dollars, then I don't think he's got a chance.
Okay.
I'm wishing, Ross Perot would come around right now.
Okay, Luke, let's put that question to Nina, because it is an interesting one in political life. If it doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, it's hard to run a campaign if you have things that are more complex.
That's right. And I don't think we're not his campaign strategists, and we shouldn't be. We were very much in writing this book, tried to be right down the middle, and we're not Kerry boosters here, so I'm not going to give advice. And I would actually bounce this question back to Brian because, as I like to say, he's sort of he's a Seabiscuit candidate. He a lot of times looks like he's falling behind, and when the competition is coming up alongside him, he picks up steam. And Brian can talk about that in the 96 campaign.
Yeah, there really is. No, it even goes further back than that. It's a pattern in his career where for long periods he runs sort of a dreary, dreadful campaign and make statements like that one Jack just read. We saw it last fall where he was trailing Dean by 25, 30 points in New Hampshire. Everyone thought he was dead. The Weld campaign, he finished very strongly. But it goes back even to his first race for the Senate in 1984 in the primary against Jim Shannon. They were running to succeed Paul Tsongas. And Kerry just ran, flat out towards the end and was a magnificent candidate when it counted. Whether he does that again this time remains to be seen.
Well, I also don't want to belabor the analogy too much, but there's also a great quote in the book about how Kerry was viewed in Massachusetts. Was he a show horse or was he a workhorse?
I think his detractors would say he's the show horse. But in the Senate, he is not that sort of legislative plowhorse type, get in, negotiate, find out where the middle ground is. That's never been his strength. And I think part of that is living in the shadow of Ted Kennedy for nearly two decades. It's a struggle to sort of create your own identity. And some of the things we wrote about, and Nina might want to talk about this, but, he would have these flights where he would try to make a dramatic statement and then run into so much flack he'd retreat.
Yeah, there are two cases in particular. One, when he condemned affirmative action in 1992, right at the same time when Bill Clinton was the front runner in the Democratic presidential primary season. And it looked to all the world like John Kerry was running for Bill Clinton's vice president, because Bill Clinton, of course, was running as a centrist who wanted to end welfare as we know it. John Kerry decided to go after a different issue, affirmative action. Frankly, did not handle it very well or nearly as nuanced as a Bill Clinton could have done. But he ran into he created a real firestorm in Massachusetts. And that's another issue, is that it is difficult for somebody like John Kerry to act like a maverick, given the political culture in Massachusetts. But he kind of had that, you know, flight of independent-mindedness and then immediately dropped this issue that he said he was going to make many speeches on. Jump forward 6 years, 1998, he gave this speech on school reform. Again, a very centrist kind of criticizing school bureaucracies. And when it was clear that and his aides at the time made it clear that this was sort of laying the groundwork for his 2000 presidential campaign. Well, when he decided not to run in 2000, he sort of dropped that like a hot potato. So he does have a reputation among critics of kind of picking up on an issue that he thinks is going to get him political traction, get him to the next level. And if it doesn't take off, he just drops it.
Jack, I want to take a phone call, but I wonder if you want to jump in for a moment before we do that.
Well, shopping for districts, shopping for issues. I mean, JFK, you know, when he came out of the service, his seat, the 10th district that he ran for, was occupied by James Michael Curley. And his father said to Curley, listen, I'll pay for you to run for mayor so that you can let my son win that seat. So he bought him out of the seat. He shopped. He literally purchased the district. And he did the same thing in the Senate. You know, when he ran for president in 1960, Arthur Schlesinger had to write a book called Nixon or Kennedy. Whom should we pick? Well, and the book was basically saying, you know, Kennedy really is a liberal. Never mind all those conservative votes and his heart of hearts. His point is, he was very much like Kerry in that respect.
To Tomahawk, Wisconsin now. Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill.
Good evening, everybody. Please understand my question. I'm a draft resister and actually refused induction into the armed services in the 60s. So for me, John Kerry is a natural candidate. I respect the position that he took when he got home from Vietnam. A couple of years ago, I was under the impression, or maybe 18 months ago, that some allegations surfaced about his service in Vietnam, I think maybe early in his career there, that there was some sort of an invasion of a village and basically a mission gone wrong. Do you know anything about that? Am I completely mistaken about this, or can you help me?
Mike Cranish was the third author of the book who researched Kerry's war years. It was very thorough. I mean, went to naval records and interviewed everybody who served with Kerry. Literally everybody who served with Kerry when he was in Vietnam. And I don't think there was any indication of that.
Yeah, I think
you may be referring.
Bob Kerry. Yeah, excuse me. That's right. Yeah. Bob, certainly with Bob Kerry,
Bob
there
Kerry,
was exactly
yeah.
that.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's true.
In fact, with John Kerry, as it just came out in the Iowa, he was the orders were if you saw anything suspicious in these villages, you could shoot at them, and he saw something suspicious and he didn't shoot and he said pull the boat in. I'll go and look and see what it is. Give me a rifle. He didn't order anybody. He went and looked, and there were 42 women and children hiding behind these hills, and he could have blown them up. Instead, he evacuated them and saved them.
Bill, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Toronto, Canada now. Tom's on the line. Hello, Tom, and welcome.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You know, this election so far reminds me of what would happen if you put 50 economists in a room and let them talk to each other for a number of months. There would be no conclusions reached, and most of the conversation would be utterly detached from reality. Now, the first caller actually set the stage for me because he said, how can John Kerry win? And at the risk of being very immodest, I think I know the answer to that question. And it's nothing that he's doing now. I'm a freelance writer and a journalist, and I travel a great deal throughout North America. And I can say that I sense wherever I go, I sense a tremendous undercurrent of discontent and anxiety seething within the American populace. And when I say American populace, I mean Canada as well, because Canada is simply a vassal state of the United States. You see civility, civic virtue, manners, they're all in fast retreat. The automobile culture has redefined human contact. And as faceless beings whizzing past each other in hard shells.
And so that's what Kerry should be talking about, Tom?
What I'm saying, I'm simply laying the groundwork for what are people's lives like today and what characterizes Americans today, and how can a quality of life be improved? Because most people don't even know their neighbors. The children are growing up, they're commoditized by big business. They're bombarded with commercial messages. Most of them can't enjoy a childhood or a youth, their youth anymore.
Okay, Tom, I think we got it. Let's put that to, let's see. Nina, you want to take a swing at that? Because it...
Gee, thanks.
Well, it is an interesting question of this whole matter, the broader question of how you connect with voters. I mean, if you are talking about the things that interest them, then they're going to pay attention. And if you are not, then they're not going to be with you.
Well, John Kerry is certainly trying to do that this week when a lot of the focus is on Iraq, is on the scandal in the prisons. He's still making trying to make headway on a domestic policy agenda and is talking about his health care plan and his intentions to insure large numbers of uninsured Americans and his intention to bring down the costs of health care and so on. So he's definitely trying to, on that issue in particular, trying to connect with voters. You know, on the broader questions, I'm not sure some of these what your caller brought up, or these broader questions, are something that a presidential candidate can necessarily address.
Although, wasn't that something Howard Dean talked about that seemed to resonate with people when he talked about the value of work and how people feel disconnected from their jobs and that sort of thing,
well,
Brian?
We live in a society, whether it's television or radio, where advertising advertisers looking for a specific demographic to sell whatever their product is to, and it tends to segment society. It's sort of sliced and diced into market segments. And I think for a candidate like Kerry, who needs to reach a broad part of the electorate, it's going to be a real challenge to find that one common unifying theme that, you know, seems to be more and more elusive as we go into the brave new world.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, this whole sort of red America, blue America, and there's been some good material written, particularly in the last couple of weeks, about how people are self-selecting where they live. They tend to live among like-minded, politically like-minded people, and they tend to take the media that reinforces their views. You know, if you're a Republican, you live in a suburb of Dallas and you listen to Fox. You know, if you're a liberal, you live in, you know, Boston and you listen to WBUR. You know, and that this kind of is encouraging this polarization of the country. So then John Kerry has to both kind of swing out of that polarization a bit and then also appeal to he's got a broad coalition to keep together. He's got to keep, you know, sort of the anti-war activist wing of the party together with a coalition that swings more to the center and try to appeal as a commander-in-chief that wants to stay in Iraq for now and, you know, not, and in fact, increase troops. And so I'm getting off topic, but it's a different, he does have a real hard row ahead of him, I think, keeping all of these people together.
But just very quickly, Brian, wasn't that what worked for him when he was in Iowa and he was out of Washington? And at that point, he really did seem to connect with those caucus.
Well, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Iowa, and it was really a phenomenon. I mean, if you had asked the 1,000 smartest people in politics 2 weeks before Iowa what the order of finish would be, none of them would have had it right. And I think very few would have had any of the four in the order they actually finished. And I don't think anyone's quite figured out what happened there, although Kerry did run a much better campaign. And I think Democrats were just looking for someone they thought could beat Bush, and by the process of elimination, you know, Edwards to an experienced Dean to erratic, Gephardt to stale, they came to Kerry.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation about the life and times of John Kerry, his service in Vietnam, and his campaign for president. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about John F. Kerry's past and his candidacy for president. Do you think he deserves to be the next president? Are you voting for him? If so, why? What makes him compelling, and what are his weaknesses? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And our guests this hour are Brian Mooney, reporter and political columnist for the Boston Globe. He's covered John Kerry for 26 years. And also from Washington, Nina Easton, deputy chief of the Boston Globe's Washington Bureau. Brian and Nina are two of the authors of the new book, John F. Kerry, The Complete Biography. And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is with us, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Want to go to the phone lines now to Madison, Wisconsin. Andrew is on the line. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to bring up recently the Bush camp brought up Kerry's medals and ribbons. And to me, this was just an opportunity for a very simple slam dunk on the part of the Kerry campaign. And if I were his campaign manager, I would just say, you know, come out bold and say, how dare you bring this up? I went there. I risked my life. And it disturbs me a little bit that that no one had the instinct to just do what a normal human being would do and say, wait a second, you know. Sure, I mean, the medals thing is a quibble. What matters is I went there. And why didn't he come out stronger on that?
Ryan?
Well, I don't think it's that simple. The story surfaced without fingerprints in the New York Times and ABC News. It was an interview Kerry had given years ago with a television station in Washington, which, according to the Washington Post, was slipped to these news organizations by the Bush campaign. So Kerry wasn't technically responding to Bush. He was responding to the news reports, and it was news. He becomes so outraged and twisted when his service record is questioned. He becomes sort of painfully inarticulate. And I think that's a function of the candidate more than the campaign.
Nina, I want to pursue that a little bit in light of his relationship with John McCain, senator from Arizona. In the world of bonds, there was certainly a bond between those two men because of Vietnam. Different political parties, obviously. But tell us a little bit more about that relationship.
Absolutely. And before we forget, I did want to mention to your listeners that all three of the authors are going to be speaking at Faneuil Hall this Thursday night at 7 o'clock. It's free. It's open to the public. So if you want to talk about John Kerry's background a little bit more, we'll be there. But the relationship with John McCain is interesting because McCain, like a lot of other Vietnam veterans and like some senators, didn't like Kerry, didn't trust him, thought he was a political opportunist. But in the late 80s, they both started looking into this issue of whether Americans' GIs were still being held captive in Indochina. And over the course of that investigation, John McCain very much came to respect John Kerry and came to understand him. They came to an understanding. They actually bonded, both bringing very different Vietnam experiences to the table. McCain, of course, having been a POW himself, John Kerry having been in combat, wounded, not seriously, but wounded three times, receiving three Purple Hearts, also a Silver Star and a Bronze. And so the two of these men investigated that question. I shouldn't say the two of them. A committee investigated that question. It was a very explosive issue at the time because a lot of families and a lot of sort of this POW MIA community was arguing very vociferously that there were Americans still left there. John Kerry, ironically, in this case, had to say, no, the American government's not lying. There isn't anybody there. They went into the Vietnam. They investigated. And the actions of McCain and Kerry enabled Bill Clinton a couple years later to normalize relations with Vietnam, which, as Ted Kennedy says in our book, was one of the most important events in Senate history of 50 years, somewhat. So it was really both a friendship and an important moment in U.S. history.
And, Brian, what about his relationship with Ted Kennedy? Does Ted Kennedy like John Kerry?
I think he does. It's an awkward situation for the junior senator to live in Ted Kennedy's shadow, as I mentioned earlier. Paul Songer struggled with it when he preceded Kerry. Ted Kennedy is just a national figure, a lion of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And there was a lot of, sort of in-state rivalry, particularly at the staff level. It went on for years. I mean, Kennedy's staff was famous for dropping dimes on Kerry, and it used to enrage him.
For example?
Well, when Kerry got up on the floor of the Senate and was railing against, soft money contributions and the pernicious effect it's having on our political culture. And, you know, 2 days later, a story appeared in the Boston Globe leaked by a Kennedy staffer that, you know, Kerry was having a $500,000 soft money fundraising event at his, you know, home in Georgetown. There were several of those. But over time, and you can sort of see it on the campaign, Kennedy, you know, a man who ran for president himself and failed, has really invested a lot of time and effort and his own personal political capital in John Kerry's candidacy for president. Has traveled with him, has traveled the country for him on his own, and raised money for him, opened doors with labor and other constituencies that Kennedy's close to. And, you know, I think Ted will tell you that the relationship with their wives was instrumental in bringing them closer. But I think it's a genuine friendship now.
Let's take another call from Boston, this time from Terry. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call. This may take a little bit of sort of getting around to get to my point, and I apologize for that, but I'll try and be brief. My question is basically this. I wonder if basically his locution is sort of hampered by the fact that he kind of has the ability to understand or agitate on all sides of an issue. In other words, if I want to know basically if, from the author's sense, if the policies that he's made in the past have been solid, and if that's a reflection of thoughtfulness, but further, if his locution is hampered by his thoughtfulness because he has the ability to sort of see all sides of an issue at the same time. He doesn't have Clinton's gift in terms of being able to present a one particular facade of something.
Okay. Thanks, Terry.
Nina, you want to take a whack?
Yeah, well,
at
there's no doubt, as we were saying before, I mean, there's no doubt that he has a very restless, powerful intellect that sees a lot of different sides of an issue and sometimes has trouble kind of settling on one of those sides. There's no doubt about that. The whole question of does he have a vision or does he have a is there a straight line of demarcation in his positions? He's on certain core issues, on abortion rights, for example, on gay rights, on the environment. He's been pretty steady. He's also shown himself somebody who's concerned about spending. He was an early Democrat to sign on to the Graham-Rudman Deficit Control Act in 1985. He expressed concern with Clinton's budget bill in 93 that it was they were spending too much. He expressed concerns about that. So he's shown signs of that. And then on the war and peace questions are more complicated. He, of course, voted against the Persian Gulf War, was very, very much affected by Vietnam. When you read that floor speech, he's thinking about creating another generation of Vietnam veterans who are, you know, in body bags or paraplegics or have emotional scars. That clearly affected him. And then, of course, coming up to the current vote on Iraq, on the Iraq war, where he seems to be, you know, he voted for the war but has criticized it ever since. He voted, you know, he voted against the 87 million, but of course voted before, you know, that sort of getting into that splitting thing. That's part of his roving mind. It's also his concerns about the application of American military overseas. He's not a pacifist. He has said that very clearly. But he does bring that Vietnam experience to these kinds of decisions.
And how do you see that, Brian?
Well, I don't think you can look at his votes on Iraq and anything other than through the lens of a person running for president. You talk to anybody who knows John Kerry and who cares about John Kerry, and they couldn't believe that he voted for the resolution. I mean, they think in their heart of hearts he wanted to vote against it, but was thinking in terms of a presidential campaign where Bush would paint him as soft on defense. What Kerry in his calculation didn't take into account was the rise of Howard Dean, primarily based on his opposition to the war, to the point where Dean was, you know, in many people's mind, the odds-on favorite to win the nomination. And I think at that point, Kerry then voted against the resolution for the $87 billion appropriation for military and reconstruction in Iraq.
Jack Beatty, I want to give you the last couple of minutes here on this topic, because if he should become president, he would be overcoming a formidable amount of history. As you know, the last sitting senator elected was JFK 40-plus years ago.
Same initial, same state, same religion, first Catholic candidate since then. Yes, he would be. You know, Walter Shapiro, who's followed him a good deal, said on the show recently that that's what Kerry is all about, bringing the Vietnam experience to the 21st century, that essentially looking at American foreign policy not as a theater of adventure or a place where you, because troops who can volunteer, you can pretty much dispatch them anywhere, but it's as a kind of, we're going to be very slow to intervene militarily under John Kerry, it seems to me. And he said as much. He said only as a last resort. And he, the implication is that Mr. Bush has done it as a first resort, and I think that's right.
Jack Beatty, thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Mooney and Nina Easton from the Boston Globe. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
The new book is John F. Kerry, The Complete Biography. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In just a moment, Nancy Reagan takes on the Bush administration over stem cell research. This is On Point. Public appearance over the weekend, Nancy Reagan challenged President Bush to change his policy on stem cell research. The former First Lady believes the use of stem cells from embryos could lead to cures for degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, which afflict her husband, former President Ronald Reagan. The Bush administration has blocked public funding of such research over ethical concerns about using embryos. Nancy Reagan made her remarks as she accepted an award from the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Here's what the former First Lady had to say.
I'm so grateful to all of you for coming tonight and showing your interest in stem cell research. When Ronnie wrote his letter to the people telling them that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I didn't really know or understand what that meant. I really didn't. But I found out those with Alzheimer's are on a rocky path that only goes downhill. Ronnie's long journey has finally taken him to a distant place where I can no longer reach him. We can't share the wonderful memories of our 52 years together, and I think that's probably the hardest part. And because of this, I'm determined to do what I can to save other families from this pain. And now science has presented us with a hope called stem cell research, which may provide our scientists with many answers they have for so long been beyond our grasp. I just don't see how we can turn our backs on this. There are so many diseases that can be cured or at least helped. We've lost so much time already, and I just really can't bear to lose any more. All of you here tonight, all of you are here tonight because you believe not just in science, but in hope. By supporting stem cell research, everyone here is a caregiver. There are so many people in this country filling the job of caregiver, and I want to acknowledge all the caregivers who right now maybe sitting beside a bed or holding a hand. So I accept this award on behalf of each and every one of them. Thank you for this honor. I'm very grateful. Thank you very much.
Former First Lady Nancy Reagan speaking at a fundraiser for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation on Saturday. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.